Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnote.com. Today we will be discussing the rallying cry to defund the police as thousands of people have risen up demanding justice for black people that have been murdered at the hands of police. And this is in the wake of what we had discussed last episode on George Floyd, and this is on the heels of Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, and countless of our black brothers and sisters that have been murdered by state-sanctioned police. So, defunding the police, I mean, that's the topic for today. If it's going to matter, if it's important, what does it mean? And I guess that's where we'll start, no? Kamala Harris went on The View and said it could mean many things. And I think that there's some explanation that should be had, at least for us to get clear what we are discussing. Because, especially for you two as socialists, I think I'm just making an assumption that there's going to be more than just defunding police. So, I don't know. Does anyone want to get started with what defunding the police is from the left, at least what they're crying out for now?
What the left is saying is that defunding the police does not mean stripping I'll just read it from, this is a woman, Linda Garcia, from the policing campaign director at the Leadership Council on Civil and Human Rights. She said, defunding the police does not mean stripping a department entirely of its budget or abolishing it altogether. It's just about scaling police budgets back and reallocating those resources to other agencies, ostensibly to schools and community resources, other social needs. I think that's what it's about. Or at least that's on the surface what it's about. I actually think it's primarily about two things. One, it's about getting this movement off of the streets, getting this uprising off of the streets, and into budget offices, into committee boards, into board of supervisor meetings, into mayoral conference sessions, talking to black leaders, and hearing their pain. And I think it's about basically saying, we're not going to do anything now, but trust us to do something later. That's the first thing. And it's primarily saying, it's very much about saying, you have acted now. Now let us act. And when I say let us act, now let the politicians act. Now let the ruling class act. We'll take it over from here. And the other major thrust of defunding the police, the defunding the police movement, is getting Joe Biden elected and getting, you know, Democrats into the Senate, Democrats into the Congress. It's a massive push to defeat the Republican Party at the polls and for the Democrats to win, under the notion that Trump cannot be moved on this, and we will elect Democrats and hold them accountable in November. So I would describe the movement to defund the police is really a movement, or it's really an initiative by the ruling class to defang the movement.
Yeah. So when this whole thing started, one of my questions was, how will the Democrats try to capture this energy? You know, because elections are coming, and obviously, their base is a bit, unmotivated, because, you know, the move they pulled with Bernie Sanders and a lot of the, you know, the most quote unquote radical Democrats, were disappointed. And, like, you know, not many people were going to vote for Biden. And so, you know, past week, we got the, you know, Nancy Pelosi and a lot of Democrats kneeling down in a symbol of, you know, allyship, I guess, you know, with the movement. We also got Joe Biden speaking at George Floyd's funeral, you know, and so the co-opting is already, you know, in process in order to, again, capture this. And like you said, I agree, you know, ultimately to take the teeth away from what's happening, you know, and the independence of the movement or whatever is happening. Because, you know, I think we said in the previous episode that, or I said maybe that the success of this movement would greatly be defined by how independent it stays from the Democratic Party. you know, because I mentioned before, you know, even during the civil rights movement, the small victories didn't come about because, you know, people voted. You know, on the contrary, it was civil disobedience, and it forced the hand of, you know, Kennedy and LBJ at the end. But even then, you know, I have more questions that we might address later, but is that enough? You know, what is the goal? What can happen? Because another thing that I have in the back of my head is that, you know, since you're a physicist, Lipson, to every action, there's a reaction. You know, and what will the shape of that reaction be? You know, and I don't know, just some thoughts, initial thoughts.
I'm glad that you two had said two things to it, which I agree with, and Andy, I'll go with you, what you said first. You're right with what you had read, that defunding the police must not be confused, that the police will not, won't, that there won't be any police. There will be police. The police will continue to have a role in this society, in the current society, in this current system. And defunding the police, as many activists and critics of the criminal justice system have been trying to bring attention to, has been to focus more on the underlying factors that contribute to the crime and move those resources that are going to in the budget that goes to the police to deal with the underlying factors such as the need for social workers and therapy and to address income inequality. And that's what that call is for, because the interval reformed that they've been trying hasn't been working for even up to today. I mean, police culture is just too strong of a culture for it to be reformed, and it hasn't, activists still see that there are issues with it, as we can see. And so I think it's clear, because when I talked to folks on Facebook, they were saying how this could potentially be the end of policing in the streets, but that's not what defunding is. And I want to get to Minneapolis soon yeah. after this, because it's interesting what they're doing there. And I agree with Kenny as well. When I saw Joe Biden at the funeral, or the video at the funeral of George Floyd, I thought then, oh, that's another strategic move to be able to go up this movement. And of course, the Democrats are going to try to align themselves with this movement to gain the support that they need for November. So I do not trust the Democrats when they are, as Kenny pointed out, they're kneeling, or they're trying to show solidarity, or they are now speaking out. They weren't speaking out before, and this is the time when they are speaking out, because of course it's the election year. I'm curious to know what it would look like if there are those that want to abolish the police, because this system that's in place will not, even if folks try to, okay, let's move away from defunding, let's abolish, it will not, this system will not ever allow for the true abolishment of the police state. So I'm in agreement with both of you that this is definitely going to look differently from how most people, this is going to look more of the same, rather, than what most people think defunding the police would do. I mean, Chauvin had what, I was just reading, I had 18, I heard on up front, he had 18 complaints against him in his 19 years of working in the police force, and three of those, something related to deadly force. Is... Even if you did defund, can you defund the actions that people take, their internal, what they're trained to do? I mean, it's just not, it's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's, you know, the police and the cops and any individual action of a violent cop you know, it's just the surface, really, because this is really just one of the many vicious institutions that, you know, capitalism has, and it needs to function. Even if we, you know, disappear cops from the streets, even if they put their uniforms away, there will be other forms of social control, you know, and in order to impose their will on us, you know, the capitalist interest, you know, there will be new modalities. And that's one thing about capitalist violence that I think, and Michelle Alexander again mentions this, that it doesn't disappear, it doesn't go away, it mutates, it evolves, and it hides itself. You know, we obviously, slavery was an economic system, you know, like, and then institutions came from that in order to sustain that system. And then when that was challenged and there was no need for it, you know, and then it evolved to Jim Crow, you know, and then from there it became mass incarceration. And then from that it became criminalization of people, you know. And so there is a direct line, you know, and so the police is only the surface, really, because when we're talking about police, we also have to talk about the military, you know. And for example, like, one idea that I heard today was that Black people are basically enemy combatants. They're handled as enemy combatants. They're stripped of their rights in the streets of this nation. That's how they are. That's why they're treated so horribly. And ultimately, at least from my point of view, maybe, you know, Lipson's, is that that serves a role. You know, that is, you know, is whipping them, hitting them so hard to, in a weird way, to say, you know what, this is how bad it could get for you, you know. And so long as we don't understand that there, you know, it is convenient, you know, for a ruling class to treat Black people like that, strip them out, basically modern slavery, you know, because that's what being incarcerated and being in the system, they take your rights away, you know, in the capitalist system. And so, you know, you lose voting rights, you have a hard time finding a job, finding housing. And so it's not an accidental thing. You know, it is by design, and it's not going to go away unless we get rid of capitalism. And you know, we can, again, Angela Davis, I have a quote from her, said, actually in the documentary 13th, the 13th Amendment, she said that historically, when one looks at efforts to create reforms, they inevitably lead to more repression. And it may not be what, you know, it may not be, the, you know, lynching, but, I mean, technically, this is still lynching, you know? It just looks different. And it actually is evolving, in as we operate, or there's a big the reconstruction of society and the new forms of intrusion into our lives, there will be higher and higher, you know, far-reaching ways of incarcerating people remotely. You know, like, for example, me being in the, you know, in the community in terms of helping immigrants, undocumented immigrants, navigate this system, they are walking around with ankle bracelets, you know, for months. You know, we know someone that had it for at least 6-7 months, you know, and how dehumanizing that is, and how, you know, traumatic that is, you know, that you are, you know, limited to an area. You can only move, you know, your movements are controlled, and you're constantly being watched, and your liberties are gone. So you may not be in a building. The buildings may fall, but ultimately the institution still holds. It still stays because it's part of this system.
Yeah. I mean, Eduardo, you mentioned this notion of police culture being almost intractable, as if it was like, as if that we could change that culture, then we could change the police. And that, I don't think it's actually police culture that's intractable. It's capitalism that's intractable and demands a police that's constructed to make sure that capitalists keep their property at the expense of workers. And that is the role of police in this country and throughout the globe. And it's true in China as well, that they are the capitalist enforcers. You can no more separate the police force from the capitalist than you can the skin or immune system from the human body. Because that's what the police are. They are a layer of protection for the capitalists to make sure that their that their separation of wealth from the working class and going up towards them is preserved and accelerated so they can continue to do what they need to do to extract profits from the working class and then expand that extraction of profits on the rest of the globe, in the case of the United States. And the degree to which they have every intention, they're not only going to weaken their police force ultimately, they can't, because they have a project on taking on China, on taking on Europe, and the only way they're going to be able to do that is to extract value out of workers, and they need the police force for that project. Now, the racism is intimately involved in that, because the modern police force was first built around maintaining the property of slavery and slaves for the southern landowners, and then it became something about putting down labor unions. But racism has always been interlaid into the role of the police force, because racism is interlaid into capitalism as a mechanism of, we're going to smash this set of workers even more, black workers and brown workers even more, so that we can get over on all of you. So the police are a working class problem, or a problem for the entire working class, but they are often directed at the most vulnerable sections. And to the extent that white workers do not see our black brothers and sisters as allies in the fight against police, that's the extent to which they will get over on us. And I think the situation in Minneapolis is an example, particularly when you think about what happened in Camden, New Jersey, of how I really do see that they're going to use this moment to act like they're making a change, but they're not going to make a change. The reason I say that, and this isn't it, I'll give two examples about one of the, I'll give an example of San Francisco of defunding the police and how it's a fake out in some ways. The defunding police, they're talking about up to $25 million being removed and reallocated somewhere else in the budget. And that's in San Francisco. That's Shimon Walton and London Breed talking about that. Shimon Walton is the supervisor, and London Breed is the mayor. So, but what's hidden underneath that? They already know that they have a $1.7 billion budget shortfall that they expect to happen. And they've already talked about how up to 10% across the board cuts are going to have to be made, including in education and other services, and possibly in the police. Well, it's very interesting to me that they're talking about a $25 million reallocation when that represents only a 4% cut in the San Francisco Police Department. So already they're projecting a lower cut in the police than they are in what they are projecting for schools and for other social services. So there's a lie already built into that. That's number one. And the Minneapolis case, I think, is really interesting, because I think the example that Minneapolis has been used as the one in Camden, New Jersey, where they abolished the police force, and they did. What they don't tell you about when they abolished the police force is essentially what it was that police force was not working. Yeah, there was abuses and things like that. But what they did was they kind of reconstituted the police force. They broke up the entire police force in Camden, New Jersey, and rehired them without their contracts. And so instead of paying $180,000 per officer, they were paying about $99,000 per officer when they cut their salaries and benefits. And so what they actually saw was that they expanded the number of police they could have, because they could hire them more cheaply while abolishing it. And that's Camden, New Jersey. And so I believe that in the context of all these austerity and budget cuts, I think what you're even looking at with this defund the police is partially just the preparations for the kinds of things they're going to do, where they have to renegotiate contracts with the police and get them cheaper, and they'll have more police. And in fact, what you'll notice is the first thing that Minneapolis did after they talked about abolishing the police was they talked, well, we're not going to be dealing with our union around its contract right now. They were prepared to do that. So they're already connecting the abolishing of the police to the union contract. Now, I'm no lover of police unions. I don't give a shit about them, but there's no question that they're going to use this to basically, in many ways, not no question, I think it's very, very cynical how it's being used. And I suspect that once this thing gets off the street, and once we take the months and even a year to finally get these changes made, you're going to see that that we didn't see any real change in the police force. You saw what you saw in Camden, which is actually Camden now has one of the largest per capita police officers per population in the country after abolishing its police force. So it's just, they lie about everything. We cannot trust them about anything. And all this is a giant lie to tell us to basically stop the uprising, to stop looters from looting, and to stop people from burning down police departments and targets. And people should not. Like they, that that uprising needs to continue, but it's going to stop. And it's not going to just stop because of the repression. It's largely going to be stopped by this co-optation. And it's co-optation. Like, I don't think people in George Floyd were like, oh, keep away, Biden. We don't trust you. This co-optation is being invited by the Black Lives Matter movement, because Black Lives Matter movement is really a wing of the Democratic Party. It's not independent. So there's nothing independent there.
They were meeting with Hillary Clinton, you know, in the last election cycle. And in order to talk about reform, of, you know, like widespread reform and this BS. It's funny because this just reminds me of Machiavelli. I was reading Machiavelli just and saying that, you know, don't use force what you can achieve with deception.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what they're doing. You know, of course, they're not. They could have repressed even harder, you know, just like send everyone home packing, bashing heads. But obviously that was going to escalate things, and they were going to find a way to take the, you know, the heat, the, you know, the flames, tone it down. And it has by and large, you know, because now we're chanting victory because, you know, reform, when we don't really understand that there will always be hidden things that we don't even understand ourselves, you know, just like, you know, any environmental thing, any like pro-labor thing, they always hide shit that we don't even know. And that's what we're going to get. And that's what I I'm wondering about that reaction. What is it going to look like? You know, and, you know, you highlighted Camden, New Jersey. So now you have, even more untrained police force, you know, that are going to be stressed out because they're underpaid. So they're going to be bashing heads because, you know, they're fucking stressed out probably, you know. And so it's not promising, obviously. It's already being co-opted. It's way underway, on its way. And even challenging these things is a minefield, you know, because then you're anti-Black.
What I'm taking from this conversation about defunding the police is that, not our conversation, but largely the entire conversation with the protesters, is that there's a recognition, there's an acknowledgement that there are underlying factors that contribute to crime. And there are activists that think that defunding the police, and as we're discussing, that it's not going to work. And I know that it's not going to work personally from an experience from being in Mexico, where the funds don't go largely to the police force. And there's still tons of police brutality that exists in Mexico. You know, police officers don't get paid a lot of money in Mexico. And there is... They do focus on their police force in the sense that they do make sure that budget stays there for them when other things have to go, but they don't get paid as much as they do here in the USA, and so police brutality will still exist even if they defund police. But as I was saying, the issues that are being brought forth with this conversation about defunding the police are true. That there are underlying things, that there are reasons why people are doing what they're doing, the looting, or there are reasons why people are stealing at people's homes, or there are reasons why there's homelessness and drug abuse and drug dealing. It's because of the lack of resources that go to them, and because of this system, the pressures of a capitalist state where you need to figure out what to do to survive if you're not economically free from thinking outside of this system, right? If you're trying to survive in the system, then yes, you know, you grew up with a family that is poor and you want to provide for a family and you're not able to, especially hold up like we are in this pandemic, you're going to figure out a different way to do so. And if this culture, a consumerist culture, promotes tons of, goods and capital for materialistic things that you want, of course you're going to want those things if you grew up in a culture where that is fed to you through commercials and tons of YouTube commercials, no? So you're going to want those things, and you're going to want to fit in, and you're going to want to get those things. And so... I think what I appreciate from the conversation, the larger conversation, is that we need to address those underlying factors of poverty and homelessness and social services, housing and youth services. Is defunding it, as you both have pointed out? No, I'm in agreement with you both that that's not going to solve the issue.
And even the language that's being used in the movement, it just shows me of how really embedded is, you know, capitalism in our, even our own psychology. Because, you know, people want to talk about, you know, investing in, like, you know, small black businesses. You know, as if that is going to say the problem. And that's, you know, when in reality is happening, that in the long run, it's going to pin one against the other, because a lot of black businesses in this city are hiring illegal immigrants and fucking exploiting them, you know, and that way we're being pinned against each other. And, you know, so pretending that black capitalism is going to get us out of it, we're going to better the circumstances, is really myopic and completely, like, naive, you know. And, yeah, so it is concerning, because it's not, I actually disagree a little bit that the bigger conversation is not really about poverty, it's about police brutality and being reactive to that. It's not really about addressing capitalism, because the language that, you know, a lot of, you know, social revolutionary socialists like Fred Hampton, Angela Davis, is not there. You know, like, it's mainly the reformist, you know, soundbites that are really, you know, on top. You know, the ones that compromise, the ones that want to negotiate. And, you know, as a socialist, I'm not renegotiating with capitalism. You know, it's a complete takedown. And so that's not what is happening. You know, because in this negotiation, we don't have leverage. You know, and the only leverage we can have is, you know, as workers, because we can choke this system down or find ways to work around it. But it's not a negotiation. But it shouldn't be. But unfortunately, that's what it's become. And we're going to lose massively. And actually, like Angela Davis said, there will be more repression, the camps in different forms, in more ways that we don't even yet know. Especially as we are reconstructing society, and there is a looming international capitalist war coming up. And they're going to stoke those fires of nationalism to try to bring them back into bullshit. You know, and so I'm waiting for that excuse to go to war abroad, you know, in order to redirect this attention to.
Yeah, and not just that. I mean, only, was it a month ago or 2 months ago, we talked about the stimulus package, and we talked about the massive redirection of funds to the top of society, the $500 billion in the stimulus that was underwriting $4.5 trillion, and that $4.5 trillion was going to the largest capitalists in this country so they could buy up assets. That we knew that was going to lead directly to the pushing of wealth to the top of society. Now, we've already seen a beginning of that with $34 billion, Jeff Bezos making $34 billion just during the time of the coronavirus. And capitalists in this country, I think they're averaging, or they're saying the total, I've heard numbers like $430 billion have been made by the biggest capitalists in this country already. And that's not talking about the Federal Reserve, what's been directed towards them. Who do you think is going to preserve their control of that money? What will the capitalists need to make sure that not only can they keep control of that money, but that wealth continues to go upward so they can fight their wars abroad and control assets abroad? The police. So we know already that unless the movement understands that it's taking down capitalism and the capitalists, that it is a movement completely incapable of dealing with the police, because our enemy is not the police. They're just the one of the first doors we're going to have to deal with, the first Doberman pincher we're going to have to deal with in dealing with the real enemy, which is the capitalist. And it is a crying shame that the entire left working class, in some way, shape, or form, by thinking of Trump as the fascist, as Trump as the bad guy, that they think that Biden is their friend. That means you are inviting the capitalist class into your movement to take it over. I'll just read a quote. This is a quote from Biden during the when he was on the floor talking in favor of the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which essentially made it so that what this Kenny situation is talking about, where literally one in three black person has a felony charge on them as a result of like three strikes laws and things like this. So the reason that one third of African-American males right now have a felony charge that makes them not able to get a job or makes it not able to get government funds in some way, not able to vote in some states, is because of Joe Biden. And here's what Joe Biden literally said during it. He goes, "We have predators on our streets that society has in fact in part because of its neglect created. They are a cadre of young people, tens of thousands of them, born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, without any structure, without any conscious developing, because they literally have not been socialized. They literally have not had an opportunity. We should focus on them now. If we don't, they will, or a portion of them, will become the predators 15 years from now. It doesn't matter whether or not they were deprived as youth. It doesn't matter whether or not they had no background that enabled them to become socialized into the fabric of society. It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they are about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. This is Joe Biden again. I don't care why someone is a malefactor in society. I don't care why someone is antisocial. I don't care why they become a sociopath. We have an obligation to cordon them off from the rest of society. And later, when people were talking about Nixon, who with his tough on crime stuff, he said this: every time Richard Nixon, when he was running in 1972, would say law and order, the Democratic match or response was law and order with justice, whatever that meant. And Biden said, and I would say, lock the SOBs up. So this is the guy that you are handing over your movement to, and this is the party you're handing your movement to. They are just as committed to attacking the working class. They are just as committed to racism. They are just as committed to lying to you. They are more deeply committed to lying to you about that. And this is why it's a wrap. To the extent that we let the Democratic Party in is the extent to which our movement is done. And it is done already. If he's there with George Floyd talking with them, it's over. It's a wrap. This movement has been taken over by the capitalists, and it's over. And the only thing that had any hope in it were the people where Joe Biden was not going to be found burning down a Target. He was not going to be found burning down a police station. That's where Joe Biden wasn't going to be. And that's where the future was. Now, of course, it's going to have to go beyond that. It would have to be more organized. But it's that sort of independent sentiment that's going to have to be harnessed. And the movement is completely incapable because it's given up on that, on doing that. And it doesn't see it. The working class is the agent of change. The workers themselves don't see that. And they've given over their control to the Democratic Party.
And again, I hope, you know, people don't think that I'm trying to personally say that Black lives don't matter. On the contrary, you know, we acknowledged that in the last episode that actually the ruling class understand they're so important. And they are important to us too, you know, in the sense that if they take one of us down, because one of ours, then we go to war with them. You know, because they took George Floyd, we should be out there, all of us, not just Black people, and, you know, and putting some white saviors in front of them, you know, in front of the police. You know, it is this realization that we have, you know, our fights are connected. It is the same fight. You know, we have different levels of oppression again, but it is the same fight ultimately. It's against capitalism, and, you know, there is no way around it, at least in my opinion, that we have to address that fundamental fact, or nothing will change. It actually will get worse, you know, with the looming things that we have coming up. And I said it again the last episode, but I am afraid that the clampdown is going to come down on those spaces, you know, that are out there pushing, you know, even if it naively, it is ultimately going to come down on Black people by us not expanding the fight, by us being afraid to be wrong, by us playing identity politics. So they're going to be hung out to dry at the end of the day, you know, because we're not expanding the fight.
I think we should address then what is a replacement for police. And I think we should address it because after having conversations with people and also sharing with them that I don't necessarily agree with defunding the police, I have been asked several times, what do you replace it with, right? And I think that as a society or as a future society, if we're to have a revolution, what does it look like to live in a state, in a country, in a system where you don't have police then? So what does that look like? I think that is an important issue that we should address. And I respond with my personal response is that will have to be, first of all, something that a community will have to come to as an agreement for how we decide together collectively what that looks like in our community, in our space, in our schools, in our, you know, first of all, I don't think police presence, not that there would be police presence in a community, an ideal community that I would be a part of, but police in schools should not be at all, even in this capitalist. I just do not think police should have a presence at all in schools. And even having seen a video that went viral where a six-year-old was picked up by a police officer just made me really upset. And I think that it's crazy to think that this, I mean, that that would have happened. I think that happened in Florida. But anyhow, that's the first thing I would say to folks that would ask. And my response would be that. Secondly, I don't think there would be a lot of crime in, as an anti-capitalist, I don't think there would be a lot of crime if those pressures of capitalism that exist currently were removed, right? Why does crime exist? Why do people steal? And the lack of resources, again, going back to the point I was making earlier, is that people do those things out of necessity or out of consumerist culture. And the crime that we see today wouldn't exist there. And thirdly, for those folks that do have mental disorders or people who have sort of psychopathic ways, that percentage of people that do exist and are very in the minority of our society. And those folks that do exist, I think there are other ways to reform, not reform as in the way that we use it politically here, but reforming the way that we have therapeutic services for those folks in order to get them in a more psychologically safe space so that we can deal folks with that, that are in the minority. And so I think that that is my response to a fair question that is brought up constantly when we talk about abolishing the police completely and not just saying, oh, let's see, you know, it's a fair question, I think, for people when they ask.
I also lived in Nicaragua, but maybe let me use Nicaragua. There wasn't a lot of police presence. Gibson went to Nicaragua, you know, and there was, you know, some crime. Obviously, there is poverty. There is, you know, hierarchy. Nicaragua is one of the least, like, stratified society, at least was. Countries is very poor, and everyone is about the same level of poor. But during the revolution, people were able to gain houses. A lot of people own houses. They don't face the constant threat of being thrown out because they can pay rent, you know. And also because they want, you know, even though it went astray, the revolution did create a different kind of society. You know, empower women. Even though Nicaraguan men, you know, are as machista as other men, but there is, you know, Nicaragua has the highest levels of women in politics in Latin America. So my point is that Nicaragua also doesn't have a lot of gang violence, as, you know, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala do, you know, which have been ravaged, you know, and it has to do with a historical obliteration of the social fabric, you know, by U.S. intervention. Nicaragua, by being successful in resisting the U.S. in not having the levels of violence that was they were facing other countries, this is my personal analysis. They were able to have certain values, community values, that have allowed them to be a healthier society. You know, they're in the U.S. they're more organized than other Central American countries. We mistrust each other, and we don't even want to participate in the political process. You know, like being Central Guatemalan, Salvadorans, Honduras, we're pretty divided. My point being is that when people bring up the question about police and, you know, for crime and this, yes, I'm like, you don't know the power of a healthy community in a healthy family. You know, and obviously that comes from economic conditions, you know, of how you make a living and the pressure that you have on you. And so, you know, it is possible. And I have a problem when we focus on criminality. That's literally the way they shove a lot of shit on our mouths. You know, because that's how Bill Clinton, that's how Nixon, that's how, you know, Bush Sr., that's how they, you know, the whole tough on crime bullshit came to be. Because they were focusing on, you know, on the most individual cases, you know, the exceptions to make it the norm and drive a narrative in order to impose some shit on us. You know, so like, you know, we've said before, we have to embrace the criminal aspects of our society, you know, because otherwise, they're gonna shove this shit, and they're gonna, you know, they're gonna tell us that we need them for them to protect us all the time. So we have to be careful when we focus so much on criminality. Because I agree with you, like, for example, there will be psychopaths and sociopaths, but even those, that's a mental health issue, you know, because even at a sociopath and psychopath, they're triggered by the context. You know, they had their preconditions to become, you know, and be violent and do their shit, whatever they do. But the conditions around them, the stressors, you know, make them do certain things. So we have to understand that people aren't just bad because they're bad. You know, we've had, you know, centuries, you know, thousands of years of evolution, you know, where, you know, we naturally organize. And yes, there is problems always, you know, but we are in a period, I believe, where scarcity is artificially created.
Yeah. Look, you can't, the criminality that is talked to that working class people so supposedly do, that is used to deflect from the criminality that our system is predicated on. George Floyd was killed for passing off a fake $20 bill, supposedly. What happened to Jeffrey Bezos when he just robbed workers of $43 billion over the last 2 months? What has happened to him? I mean, how did he get that money? Did somebody hand it over to him? Did somebody, this is yours? It was in my pocket, now I'm going to hand it over to you? That's theft. I'm sorry. Capitalism is based on theft, on exploiting workers, on not paying them as much as their value of their work. That's what exploitation is. So, and that police force is there to protect that theft. That's what they're there to do. They're there to ensure that that theft continues to happen to workers every day. So you can't talk about abolishing the police without talking about abolishing education, as public education as it is, without abolishing City Hall, without abolishing the White House, without abolishing Amazon, without abolishing Google. All of that stuff has to go and has to be replaced by institutions that workers establish. So we can't talk about just, okay, how do you take this one thing out and then put that in and keep the rest, or even reform a little bit? You cannot do it. The whole thing has to be brought down and rebuilt under new ownership, and that has to be on the ownership of the working class. How does that happen? Well, in a sense, what happened with George Floyd gives us a little, the uprising that took place around it indicates the potential for that. When you see that the uprising that took place in one city went to another city, and the massive support that it garnered. And I don't just mean the protests. I mean what people are calling the looting and the burners, the rioters. I'm talking about those elements, the independent elements. If that fire that was in those people was organized by workers collectively, then I guarantee you we could take their system down. But it would have to spread across the country. It would need to be organized. And we'd have to see, it would be built out of the kinds of strike committees and organizations. Those new organizations would be the things that would make decisions about how society would be run. They would, to the extent that they needed a police force, the entire police force would be disbanded, and we would build a workers' police force if we needed such a thing. I don't know if we would. I don't, you know? But all I know is that you cannot talk about these things in isolation. You can't talk about, well, what would you do with the police if you abolished it and then keep everything around it? Because the police are built into the cake already. They're baked in. So if you get rid of them, then they are there to make sure that Jeffrey Bezos doesn't ever go to jail for stealing $43 billion over the last 2 months, and that George Floyd gets killed when he passes a fake 20. That's what the police are there for, are there to do, because they are the capitalist enforcers of inequality, and they're there to ensure that that inequality continues and gets worse.
Sometimes those murders are seen almost justifiable by people in the media or people who are misguided or misinformed when they think that a black person has done something to deserve that murder.
That's racism.
And they may not say it.
Yeah, right. But that is the spoils of racism. That is racism ripping through your country, ripping through country, getting into the minds of workers and telling them somehow that it's okay that 2.3 billion black people are, or 2.3 billion people are in prison, primarily black, or it's okay. Like somehow they think that there is some sort of justification for that. And Jeffrey Bezos and you know, Larry Ellison and what's that dude who's Tesla? All these people get away with whatever. And
Elon Musk.
Yeah, you know, it's those are the, that is how racism F's us up, you know, in the same way that we see immigrants as our opponents as they come into our country. Like that F's our shit up. It makes our movement paralyzed. And every time we ask that some Democrat do something to get immigration under control, but don't put them in cages, but maybe make sure there's a legal process. No, workers should come here anytime they want because we need to organize them to take down our ruling class. That is the only answer we can have. Any other answer is a concession to somebody smashing the head of a fellow immigrant worker that we cannot abide because we have to smash their heads. We can't allow them to smash ours.
I mean, I agree with Lipson. It's just, the details are complicated, especially in this context of, you know, identity politics and, you know, privilege, you know, which is so messy. And like, I mean, I don't think that there aren't some elements, you know, of, you know, challenging, you know, traditional structures, especially on our work sites, because, you know, if you want to organize a work site, you cannot out your fucking sexist, you know, coworker, you know, to bring his bullshit into it. You cannot allow your racist coworker to bring their bullshit into it, especially as you're building a movement, because I do believe that there's a transformative process when you're fighting together, you know, in the struggle, you know, where you will see each other differently. But obviously getting started is so hard because this shit is so ingrained and it is, you know, centuries of this bullshit, you know, and ultimately they also, you know, capitalism does pick winners and losers, you know, winners and losers. And if you're winning, you know, it's like, you know, you, at least if you perceive that you're winning, you know, but more and more, at least like for me personally in the Bay Area, a lot of the people that I'm surrounded with, some of them are quote unquote professionals. But they're in the same boat. We're landless peasants in the Bay Area. You know, we will never fucking own shit. You know, and they work hard and whatever, but, you know, we're in the same boat, you know, of losing. And we have a common enemy, regardless of your fucking color, regardless of your sex. And ultimately, me, you know, because I'm not about that shit, why the fuck does it matter? Why should you lead with that? You know what? You know that is dehumanizing. That you have to deal with your struggles. I'm just Kenny. You know, like that's why I stopped telling my fucking story. You know, like how painful and this and that. I don't care if you understand me on a personal level. You'll care, and we'll talk about it. But you know, when I'm meeting you, I don't have to deal with that check boxes to get some, you know, permit to talk. No, I'm not asking for permission. I'm gonna talk because I have to talk. You know, and I have a voice. But, you know, but this becomes this bullshit where, you know, and again, like then in politics, where you have to check boxes before you're allowed to talk and be elevated. And then we get frauds for like, you know, Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, you know, like going after unions and sending the cops out there, even if she talks about, you know, and she's a black woman, you know, queer black woman. She checks all the boxes of the most oppressed. Maybe she just needs to be poor, you know, and then, you know, she has all the boxes, but she's part of the ruling class, just like London Breed is in this city. Just like the principal, you know, lives in school, whatever. I'm not allowed to say that, but, you know, that they put people in there so you don't challenge them. You know, people of color, people of marginalized people that represent marginalized people, they put them in positions of power so we don't challenge them. Because obviously we are going to challenge white men, you know, but they've learned their trick. And so we got to be careful. We got to be willing to challenge them both. But obviously, they have weaponized racism against us, you know, against the working class, ultimately.
Hey, Kenny, you had said something about back where you're from or where you were living in Nicaragua. It brought me back to in my country, in Mexico, where we have had an episode about this before, and I forget what, where we talked about this. But in Mexico, there are communities without police because the police is so corrupt.
Yeah.
And so they have their own, for lack of a better word, peacekeepers. That word is, you know, opted.
Was that by Oaxaca? Or no, was it the Chiapas? In areas of Chiapas?
Yeah, in Chiapas, yes, but other communities as well up north, because of so many of them were just completely corrupt and also were working with a lot of the drug traffickers. So their communities themselves were decided, you know what, we don't need, they truly abolished, they didn't just refund or distribute or allocate resources somewhere. They completely got in their community, not in the country. I want to be clear because there's still police force in Mexico, and I don't want to deny that to them. But in these small communities, I can mention, I'll probably put a link in three communities that I know of. They did abolish completely. They truly did, and their community. And the crime went down. You know, these are people that they're in their community deciding and talking to their appointed people as elders. And is it a capitalist state? Yes, it's still a capitalist state. I don't want to say that it's not. But just for folks that I think are too worried or too scared or have fears around, like Kenny was saying, that sometimes it's ingrained in our head, or did you say, Andy, I'm not sure, but, you know, to think that we need a police force to control, because we humans, we cannot live without some form of control, you know, there are communities that do exist that are not socialist communities per se, but there are communities that do work collectively without a police force, and they have a reduction in crime. These are their own fathers and their own uncles and their own aunts, even the women who are involved, who are so-called policing. They're not really policing, but have mediated conversations that do go out in the community, and they know one another, you know. So just for that, to quell some of those fears, there are other societies that we deem to be underdeveloped or not civilized enough that do a better job at creating communities where they're safer than the communities we have in so-called developed worlds. So yeah. I just wanted to touch on that little bit because I think it's ridiculous when people start thinking we need something to take care of, you know, the crime, you know, that exists. I mean, my neighbors watch out for my house and I watch out for their house and we're taking care of ourselves, and that's not a policing thing, or, you know, that's not large scale. But what I'm saying is, when you have relationships, when you have a community, when you have people in your life, and as Kenny said, we didn't have policing for a very long time. So it's just, it's hard for people to even fathom it, but it can happen.
Yeah, just another example. In Guatemala, there are Mayan communities, or, you know, that because they couldn't trust the state, because their state literally wanted to impose capitalism on them as recent as the 80s, you know, in 90s, you know, they use, you know, under U.S. backing, terrorists, you know, state came and wanted to impose their will. So, you know, move to now, they don't trust, the military is not allowed there, basically, you know, and they themselves organize themselves to police. And even, you know, another form of capitalism, which is, you know, fucking narco traffic. And I want to have an episode of, you know, related to this someday.
We should.
But, you know, that form of capitalism doesn't take root there, you know, because they drive them out. You know, they have control of their own communities. Just going back to this, the details, right? Like, I agree, you know, some people need the details, and I don't have them all. You know, I can't cover every angle. I am all about the fundamentals, you know, because you will be able to understand the link between this and that once you understand the fundamentals and make your own decisions, you know, make your own ideas. But I think I often find it that the people that ask for the details struggle with letting go of this illusion that, you know, voting is not going to get you anywhere. You know, putting the string hard enough to know that capitalism is a fucking fundamental problem. You know, and so the people that focus on the details are really obscuring the bigger picture and don't want to really dive into it. So, you know, I sometimes engage, but I always say, let's discuss the fundamentals, because otherwise we're going to waste time here.
To me, I think as much as we can talk about racist ideas being a barrier for the working class, or sexist ideas, nationalist ideas, the reality, and I don't know if we might not agree on this, but the reality is that the only way those ideas are going to be fundamentally changed and challenged within the class, even is in struggle. It's going to be racist and sexist and nationalist workers in the United States who engage in the struggle against capitalists, and it's going to be in that struggle that they are going to learn how divides are going to be used to break their movement, and they're either going to contend with that thing materially by uniting across national boundaries or across racial boundaries or across gender, or they will be defeated in that struggle. That is the primary thing that is missing from our country, is struggle. And And what do I mean by struggle? I don't actually mean protest. I mean a struggle means our class organizing itself to fight the capitalist. Primarily, that's going to be strikes. I actually think what's taking place in these cities and the uprising is an aspect of that struggle, which is challenging the capitalist. It's not organized enough. It's not ideologically coherent enough to express itself in a way that says, this is what we demand, this is what we want, so it's going to be taken advantage of in that regard. But at least it's independent, so we have to be independent. And so I do think that's one thing people have to understand, is we can't even begin to talk about the reconstruction of society until we engage in the fight. You don't think of it in your head first and then do it. You have to engage in the fight and then figure out what gets constructed to win that fight. And that's how this is going to work. And that's what the yellow vest was so important. That's why what happened in France was so important. That's why this coronavirus thing, which has flattened all this stuff out, is so deadly. It is also, though, why I took much heart in going to the demonstrations at Mission, despite the politics there, the fact that people at least knew they wanted to be together. That peace, that understanding of needing to be together and that we were going to have to defend ourselves. If you put that sentiment into war with capitalists, then we have a chance of actually changing ourselves on an international way to be capable of running society. Because we aren't capable of running society right now. If aliens came down and ruined the ruling and removed the ruling class and just left workers as we are right now, no struggle workers as we've been doing, we would fucking fuck it up in 20 minutes. We'd fuck it up as bad as the capitalists, I would actually say. The only way we will become fit as a class to lead is if we get into the ring and start fighting our enemy and figure out what do we have to do to fight them effectively. And it turns out you got to fight racism, you got to fight sexism, not as a moral thing, but you have to see those ideas as weapons of the other side used to demoralize your side. And that, because that's what they will be, how they'll be used. So I'll just say that.
And just to build on that, or I guess maybe summarize it, the way I see it is that on the left now, as it stands, we have it wrong. We think that by changing, we can change culture and that will change power dynamics, you know, but that's not how it works. You know, this is a Marxist idea that you have to change the fundamental power dynamic at the bottom, you know, the dictatorship that we face every day, most of us, you know, at work, in order to allow a new society to be constructed, you know, and so we can shame people and people will pretend they understand, or some people will likely build walls and actually fall back into what they feel comfortable in because no one wants to be fucking stepped on, you know, so we cannot expect to change culture just by that. And a lot of this bullshit, especially in San Francisco, comes from this sense of we live in a bubble. Most of the world is conservative. You know, most Latinos are going to vote conservative if it wasn't for immigration. You know, and we're going to have to contend with these realities that we live in a bubble. You know, and so to change culture, we're going to have to go after capitalism in the struggle and deal with this bullshit that Lipson said, you know, that we're going to face with each other. You know, and I've seen examples where, you know, like sexist men from Mexico have, you know, told me their stories where they stood up for women, you know, that were being pushed out because they didn't want to have sex with their bosses. And they got fired. The guy got fired. But this sexist dude stood up for coworkers. But, you know, but it gives me hope when I hear these stories because we are complex people, obviously. You know, and we actually, there are fuck-ups and then there are some fuck-ups. But we're going to have to allow ourselves to make mistakes and correct our ways. You know, because right now, as it stands, we want people to be perfect, you know, and that's why people bow down and don't challenge the mainstream ideas because they want to fit in.
And when you invite the Democratic Party in, when you invite politicians in to solve your problem, you are, it's literally ending the war. You are declaring yourself in defeat. You are surrendering yourself over to it. And it's done. It's a wrap. So that is what is so damaging about this defund movement is not one, it won't work, and two, it's only constructed to do one thing, which is to basically get the movement off the streets and allow the capitalists to reclaim control of a situation that they're a little nervous about. And I guarantee you, with the they know which way the economy is headed over the coming months. They know they're going to use that as a whip against the working class, so they need to get this thing moved off the streets, and then they'll be able to reclaim the initiative under conditions of austerity, under conditions of unemployment, under conditions of panic that people are going to have. And unless we build a movement that's capable of taking the entire capitalist class on, they are going to continue to divide us along these fears. And they know it. They know they have us. as long as we don't challenge them at the base of production, challenge them on the idea that they get to run society and they get to control things. If we don't, if we run it through voting for them or doing whatever, like, then they have us.
Maybe I always think of nothing to add, and then I do think of
final word.
There is this thing that's kind of I'm trying to figure out, and it's not necessarily defunding the police, but I do think that we should organize in our communities right now for a greater transformation, yes. Mm-hmm. And where we can start is in our own, wherever we are. If you're in the union, I think just, or as a family advocate, I think wherever force you're in, I think that we should start declaring that we want the police state out of our community. That is, if you're in a neighborhood or if you're in a school, I personally will start advocating at whenever school starts, and whenever I get organized with other families at my nephew's school, I do want the police. I don't want the police to show up at the school, and maybe this conversation around defunding, around asking police to be replaced by something else, isn't a revolution. It's maybe a reformist solution. I'm not necessarily wanting just to stay at that, but I do think that those conversations are important to say in our community. I don't want this police in the presence of my community. And if you're, because at the school where you work at, I'm not sure necessarily if there are police that still are allowed. Are they? All right. I think as a community, they need to say, we don't want, this is not the solution. We don't want police to come in here to our school to control our children, to prevent or to what. It's just they don't belong in schools. And just like I said with that viral video of this child, the resort that adults go to request for help isn't the solution for our children. And other places as well. I'm having struggling where else besides schools. Of course, you know, I'm thinking neighborhood communities. It just, they don't belong in our communities.
The intentions are noble, I guess. You know, like, I'm not, you know, people, but let's be honest with ourselves. You know, like, that's what I'm saying. And maybe when we are honest, we'll be able to recognize these things and be prepared for that. You know, be prepared for that co-opting of the Democrats. You know, be prepared for, you know, advancing the conversation to understand that this is not just about cops. This is, you know, I care, you know, and like, yeah, fuck the cops. I don't give a shit about them.
Right.
But we gotta be watchful because, you know, history is unforgiving. You know, and that's why we read history, I think, and in order to understand, like, you know, what happens and how this shit morphs and it will morph. And that's my fear, that we're, you know, like by us chanting victory, you know, we're actually going to get a fucking bash in the head real bad, you know, more than we thought. And that's why I'm, you know, I am with the movement to an extent that it challenges capitalism, you know, and I'm not saying like, I'm not against Black Lives Matter. No, hell no. I understand. You know, like, I feel for them. And I would like us to further the fight, you know, to go after the source of all this. You know, but I'm not optimistic because of what's transcribed at this point. So, yeah, I don't want cops, you know. I don't want institutional punishment, period. You know, and you know, the coercive, I don't want the military, I don't want ICE. Just like everyone, you know, out there with those sentiments. But I think, and I don't know how to put it in a better way, but we got to grow the fuck up, you know, like, and stop, you know, chanting Disney-fied slogans. We gotta prepare to go to war with the capitalist class.
Public schools are institutions of exploitation and preparing workers for future exploitation. So whether cops are there or not, public schools under capitalism are systems of deciding how workers will be trained so they can be fit to be exploited and which workers are fit to be exploited, whether cops are there or not. So we can remove all the cops from San Francisco, out of the San Francisco schools, but cops are going to be intimately in the lives of all our students because they are intimately in the lives of making sure the capitalist has control of all the wealth and that they as workers never get a taste of it and they continue to get exploited. The reality of taking cops out of schools is a wash, actually. In Oakland, there's a bunch of cops in schools, and there are still over 2,000 calls that came to police officers because of somebody had a gun or somebody had something. That kind of situation is going to get more as the divide between rich and poor grows more, right? So we know there's going to even be more gangs, more violence that we're going to see within our own students because they're getting more despair, more lack of hope. And so instead of having a cop who's there who can't have a gun on the campus, you'll have a cop that's being invited who has a gun. So it's a wash to me. Honestly, I'm not going to portray this myth that just because a cop isn't inside the school, that cops are not intimately baked into the experience of their lives and my life into making sure that these institutions continue to exploit you, because that's what's happening. So whether we have a cop there or not, that's why it's not a step forward. It's actually a step backward to the extent that it fools you into thinking you don't have to go on strike in August. That's what I would say. So if any teacher doesn't think we have to go on strike in August because we got rid of the cops in the schools, then they're a fool. And the reason we have to strike in August is not because of health. It's not because of coronavirus. There's only one reason we have to go on strike in August, is because we have to shut the system down and take it over a new authority. This gets us back to, you know, something I wrote about. The only reason for teachers to strike in August is to spread the strike to other workers so we can bring down the society. And if we don't do that, then we're done.
It's just going to go on a back and forthy about whether, you know, me saying that for the meantime, we need to get rid of cops, and you both want to take down the entire system, which I agree with. So I'll just leave it at that. I agree with you. So I agree. You're right. And the school institution is, I mean, I don't want teachers to just all of a sudden, you know, decide that they've had a victory. You know, as Kenny said, once you might have a victory, then that's it. You don't fight further, right? Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
And just to maybe, and again, if you want to engage or not, there is no meantime. You know, it morphs into ways that we don't even imagine yet. There is no meantime. There is no harm reduction in this thing. In this game, you know, we actually, by engaging in harm reduction, we are causing more harm, and we're further and further away from the fight that we need to fight.
Right. And just to be concrete about this, like, for Kenny, that means the immediacy means you're trying to put together a Communist Manifesto study group. For me, the immediacy means finding a few extra socialists who might feel like we want to talk about socialism as the immediate task, not some far off task. That's what I'm trying to do here in this podcast, but also, you know, at my work. This is what I'm trying to do. We're very far away from that thing, but it is an immediate task. Right. There's no other thing to be done right now other than to begin to build towards that one thing. And falling for side things just gets us deflected and just turns us, our brains, into mush, unfortunately, and makes us think that everything's okay. Eduardo, what it means for you, I'm not sure. I actually think your involvement in this podcast is part of that process of helping us clarify these things. So honestly, I feel like by even agreeing to do this, you're doing that part to help the because this conversation is going to be part of that construction for that fight.
I thought long and hard about what it means for me. I'm still trying to unfold what that means for me. I will be transparent. Currently, for me, it means... I think we can create another episode for this, but I just will lightly touch on it. That for me, it means about, you know, when I think about what would be my contribution for a revolution, well, I'm a permaculture designer. I believe in food security and agricultural systems that are aligning with that doesn't destroy the ecosystem. And for me, it means about food security in our communities. For me, it means having these conversations with you all to stir up and ruffle feathers, especially progressives and reformists. And for me, it means engaging in the school politics of my nephew's school, which I think will be the next niche where I will follow in. And, you know, whatever Kenya is doing with his socialist reading group, I would like, you know, we had discussed it, and he had said that he would like to invite me, and that might be another place where I might have another developing self-awareness of socialism. For me, those are the current venues where I think I'm trying to explore, and as well as get networked with other folks that can reaffirm a lot of the things that we have been talking about here. For example, just the online distance learning issue. And I had talked about you about the reasons why I would like to invite other folks to talk about this as a psychological point of view. And so that means for me connecting us with other people that may not necessarily be politically so aligned with any one of us, but it is about creating those, the camaraderie that maybe, as I believe, it isn't just about connecting with socialists. It's also connecting with people who could potentially be part of that struggle and fight if they move on to the train, right? That's how I think of it. Kenny, I'm sorry, I spoke too much.
I'm just trying to replace two old timers. You know, their time has come and gone. Brian's going to laugh.
Dude, man, please replace me. No, I want to go to Albuquerque with Brandy and just hang out with Kizmo.
This group that I work with in this community, my goal is to make them understand that our work is not fucking charity. It's solidarity with, like, you know, undocumented workers. You know, that we're part of this working class and have these conversations openly. And I don't know, maybe we'll become a radical group. You know, the likes of the Black Panther. Maybe, who knows? Maybe not. You know, very likely not. But it's also about creating the networks within the community, you know, for food security, you know, because at some point it will be a game of attrition, you know, and just creating networks and relationships and to understand that we're in the same fight, you know, that being separated, but, you know, and we self-segregate because of the institutions and stuff, but to understand that we're in the same fight. And, you know, so yeah, everything I do and, like, you know, this podcast helps me think a lot and expose my ideas. And ultimately to me, it's being honest and open about it.
Yeah.
Because if you're not, then, you know, your ideas aren't, you know, they're good for nothing. You know, you have to be open. You have to be willing to be wrong. And, you know, that's why I am an open, unapologetic, revolutionary socialist. Even if I'm fucking naive, you know, to realize that someday they might use this shit against me, you know, to declare me an enemy of the state.
I wanted to both say to you, I guess I'm just worried that folks, revolutionary folks, are too concentrated. I was out in my garden, you know, I grow my own food. And I was just thinking as I was growing my own food, I'm worried, I'm concerned for revolutionary folks that are delving into the conversations and the ideological aspect of it, where, you know, I don't know if, where is the training if you're going to get armed, if they're all ready to get armed? Or what about, you know, like Che Guevara was a doctor, you know, and where is the training for to make sure you have food security, right? These are just things that I guess we can discuss. I'm not necessarily wanting this on the... If you want to, you can edit. I don't really care. I'm just... I guess we moved from defunding the police to what it... You asked the question, actually. This is how it started it, Andy. You said, what does it mean? And we were discussing, the three of us, what it means for us personally. And I had said food security. I think that we need practical skills. Revolutionaries need practical skills to be able to survive, as well as delve into the ideological aspect. But it just feels to me that a lot of the groups that I have attended in and also have spoken to with other socialists, there's so much of that intellectualizing, and so much. There seems to be not enough of the practicality. It's a lot of things we have to do besides just talking to people.
Yeah.
So, and you know, there is a training ground that needs to happen. So that's, we're just delving into this because, again, from that question. So I am concerned. And if we look at the Seattle strike and we look at the Paris Commune, you know, they, some of those folks were just because they had gone from, they were either nurses and were able to, but still there was a shortage. Yeah, I looked in the Paris Commune, there was a shortage with, for example, their resources for food.
Yep.
And how would they be able to survive without, you know, so you can only sustain a revolution for so long if you don't have these other resources. We are humans and we need to try to build on these skills. So that's why I had said, you know, I am trained in permaculture, and for me it means about if my contribution is going to be added there, I may not necessarily be a leader, but I certainly will make sure we have something to eat.
Yeah.
Anyhow, let's move on. Or unless you both wanted to say something, but that's what I'm...
I think it's very promising that you read about the Paris Commune, and I think more people will have to do that and grapple with some of the questions that you're asking.
In practical terms, too.
Yeah.
You know, again, I agree with you completely. You know, and that's why we say that this knowledge, this understanding needs to be in the hands of the working class. You know, because if you read Marx in a college, you know, class, it's as good as going to a museum.
Yeah.
You know, so,
I agree, Kenny.
You know, so yeah, that's what I want.
That's my. We have actually talked about this, Kenny. You know, sometimes this gets too.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I've told you this as well, Andy. I'm just too concerned. This is just a bit elitist thinking, and not enough on the ground. Materially, it's not as. It's not. I don't want to just.
Yeah.
Talk here.
You know? And that's why, like I mentioned, my community work, that, you know, we are doing this work, but I want to make sure that I share my opinions of why I'm doing this work. I don't know why you're here, but I'm here for this reason. And maybe some people will realize that, you know, and will agree, hopefully. But, you know, like, it's not some theoretical bullshit that I read in college. It's like, I'm here because I see this, and we need to do this. And we need to be ready for this possibility, you know. But it requires conversation, you know, and also, I agree, like, it requires this kind of conversation, not the bashing, like, let me tell you about it, like, you know, what do you think, you know, and I'm working on that, but, you know, how do you see these parts, you know, playing out, and then, at the same time, just not being apologetic, this is what I think, let's talk about it if you want to.
Right.
Yeah.
And the question comes, what do you think, and that think. When a set of workers are talking to each other about what they think freely, there is something going on there.
Yeah. Anyhow. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast that's channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes wherever you found this episode or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com, and you can find past episodes to this podcast/channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 5-6 platforms.
Yeah.
6 platforms. Thank you, Andy. We are now on Spotify. Thank you. And iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts Kenny Cepeda and Andy Lipson. We'll check you all out next week. Thank you.
All right. See you.